Ladies and gentlemen, I guess we're about ready to start the afternoon session. With informing people in foreign countries about United States foreign policy, American life and culture. Its operations include the Voice of America, broadcasting more than 900 hours weekly in 36 languages. Production and distribution of television and motion picture films, publication of periodicals and direction of cultural centers, libraries and exhibitions. The cultural and press attachés in all United States embassies are USIA officers. Prior to this governmental service, Mr. Shakespeare held the following posts: President of CBS Television Services, in charge of worldwide distribution of CBS television programs and news services, and Senior Vice President of CBS Television Network. In short, Mr. Shakespeare is superbly qualified to speak on the title of the subject, The Communications Explosion and the Struggle for the World. Mr. Shakespeare.
Thank you, Tony. You know, it's very difficult to follow the eloquent Bob Moss, who I admire enormously. That English accent is always so appealing. I'm reminded of the comment that was made that every American thinks secretly in his heart that if you woke an Englishman up in the middle of the night shouting fire, that he'd jump up and speak American. I'm going to talk about something that I feel about very deeply, and I'm really convinced that I'm on to something with it. That's the reason that when Henry Gregory asked me if to come, I accepted immediately, because it's something I do want to share with you. I'm going to make a series of points without going into depth with the backing of them. I only wish to say that this is a matter that I have thought about through perhaps 4 or 5 years, gradually, through an osmosis process of experience and reading and chatting and absorbing and traveling and that sort of thing. And I believe it's very significant. The points that I will make are essentially that there really is an extraordinary revolution that has occurred in our lifetime and our father's lifetime, approximately 60 years, and that's the communications revolution. And that secondly, coincident with the communications revolution, there has been another revolution, and that's the revolution of nationalism in its present virulent state in the world. And that's occurred almost in the same time frame, namely from World War I to the present time. And that the relationship between the communications revolution and the nationalism revolution is both coincident but also causal, one to the other. And that those two things, the communications revolution and the nationalism revolution, taken together, have very important impact on United States foreign policy and considerations of United States foreign policy. Now, those are the points, essentially, that I plan to make with you. Let me go very quickly into the communications revolution. We can start with McKinley and say that McKinley went to his inauguration in a vehicle which was essentially unchanged from that in which the pharaohs went to theirs some 6,000 to 8,000 years previously. That's important because the communications revolution began, in the sense that we're going to talk about it here today, with the development of the internal combustion engine, with the car, and with the airplane, more or less about 1910. Because that meant that for the first time in the history of the world and all of man's experience in the world, people could move about. Prior to that time, most people were born, lived, and died, and never went further than 100 miles from where they were born, and never met anybody that had been further than that from where they were born, except the very rich or a very few who happened to be intrepid adventurers. Now, the reason for that is that it took so long to go somewhere, and it was so costly to go somewhere, that only people who had considerable leisure and some substance could do it. So when you consider the communications revolution, remember that only since about 1910 could people really travel, common, ordinary people. And the most effective form of all communication is obviously person to person. And then with very great rapidity, you had a whole series of devices invented largely by Americans, as it turned out, the use of which triggered the real revolution in communications. You go to the 20s and you have radio. And so for the first time, it became possible to take the human voice with all of its persuasiveness and all of its articulation and all of the thought built into it, and to throw that voice hundreds and then thousands of miles away, initially on crystal sets and now on satellites. And at the same time that that occurred, it became possible for the first time in history to represent human action and the human experience visually in something more than a freeze frame. Because in all history before that, all we had had was a painting. And a painting is simply a freeze frame of some creative person's impression of a human experience or a human situation or a reality, frozen in eternity in that split second that he reflects it. And it suddenly became possible to take the human experience through time, through motion pictures, and then eventually to add to it the human voice. Now, simultaneously then, you had two extraordinary things happen. The ability to project for the first time one man's thinking in his own words into the minds of other people in something other than person to person. You had motion pictures, the ability to travel by automobiles, and the beginning of the ability to travel by airplanes. And then with very great rapidity in our own lives in the last 25 years, you had an onrush of devices. You had the jet engine, which did all that it did, and you have stereophonic sound. You have high-speed presses. You have transistor radio. And most extraordinarily of all, you have television. And then you add to television satellites. Now, all of these devices have taken, in two generations, our fathers and us, and transformed the way the people of the world are informed, how quickly they're informed, what they know, and the visceral impact with which it hits them. The last point is very important. Through all the centuries prior to then, people perceived things and got to know things slowly. You absorbed things slowly. You absorbed it by books. You absorbed it by thinking. You absorbed it by gradual conversation with your friends. Things took years or months or weeks to get out. And so society moved with mankind, perceiving things gradually and slowly over a period of time and absorbing them. And now, all of a sudden, all that is gone forever. People get the same information, often at the same time, in a blockbuster way emotionally. Take the case of Roots, which was just on ABC. 130 million Americans saw a portrayal of history at the same time, in the same way, with the same emotion. Now, what that means sociologically to the mood piece of a people is something with which society has no experience. Our children are the first children of television. Our children are the first of mankind's children who have never known a day when television didn't exist. Now then, to wrap up just aspects of the communications revolution, it's 50 to 60 years old. It's a real revolution. It has to do with the transmittal of ideas. And it's something that is so rapidly, has so rapidly come upon us that we don't yet know what it's doing to society or what it will do to society. Are there any indications? Yes, there are some indications. The children of the 60s, in all of the free world, that is the world where the communications revolution was permitted to operate, were the most inferment, the most unsettled, the most anti-institution and anti-tradition of any generation of teenagers or children perhaps ever. They ripped the lid off in all of the Western world in the 60s. Is it coincidence or is there a causal relationship that they were the first children who went into their teenage years as television-raised children? We had the blacks in this country as second-class citizens, slaves initially, and then second-class citizens for roughly 100 years, 1860 to 1960. They were in many ways technically freed, but they were second-class citizens. And while they didn't like it, they reasonably accommodated to it because of the power of the establishment in the country. And then all of a sudden in 1960, after 100 years of reasonable accommodation to a distressful situation, the black elements, the minority element, the disadvantaged element in our societies ripped the lid off. Same thing that happened to youth. There were riots right across the country. There was immense ferment and more disturbance than we had ever known among minorities. Is it coincidence or is it cause and effect that that black generation was similarly situated as the first generation of our time impacted by television and by some of the growing effects of the communications revolution? Now, I make those as observations. We're much too early in the communications revolution to know if those are cause and effect. The coincidence seems astonishing and probably indicative of a real causal relationship, at least in my view. Now, let me go to a political matter. There is, in the Western world, extensive instability in politics. I suppose it really started when the old order broke up in World War I, because while this communications transportation revolution and impact of ideas and ferment was taking place, two world wars took place just in the same time frame. And they broke up the old order. Obviously, we all know how they broke it up. In World War I, all the land-based empires, that is, people, nations who ruled other nations contiguous to them on land, such as the Russian Empire, or No, that's not true in the case of the Russian Empire. The Turkish Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire were all broken up. The reason they were broken up is because the victors were the sea-based empires, people that ruled other people away overseas through the force of navies. And after 25 years, there was a Second World War. In this case, the sea-based empires won again, but this time, the force of events was so great that even the victors could not keep their empires together. And the sea-based empires broke up. And French Indochina became Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. And the Dutch East Indies became Indonesia. And India became India, and then a terrible struggle, and it became India and Pakistan, and then a terrible struggle, and it became India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. Now, all of that was the emerging of something which was caused in part by war and the chaos of war, and in part by something that seemed to be happening to the minds of men, women, by the communications revolution. It was no longer possible for victors to hold together an empire, assuming that they were going to have enough freedom so that the communications revolution could work its way. Now, if we move very rapidly up to the present time, to take just the situation that we live in right now, let me run through some things that have happened in the last 6 months. In Pakistan, there is rioting within the last 2 months that's said to endanger the Bhutto government. In France, the government the cabinet resigned after massive local election defeats of Giscard by the Gaullists. The United Left of the Socialists and Communists, as you all know, won a majority of the popular vote. The president, Giscard, finds his popularity waning, and he finds that both the left and the right are deserting him. And the target is the legislative elections next spring. It's fair to say that the government of France finds itself in a very unstable situation. The United Kingdom, the British government, within the last few months, survived by a shotgun wedding of the Liberal Party and the Labour Party with the Scottish and Welsh nationalists as voters playing quite a role. The Labour Party had to make a deal in order to survive a confidence vote. It's fair to say that the Labour government in England is hanging on by its fingernails. In Belgium and in Holland, in the last 2 months, there have been uncharacteristic cabinet crises. Caretaker governments are limping to the polls in both countries, the Belgian election tomorrow and the Dutch election on May 25th. Extraordinarily enough, the Dutch coalition cabinet collapsed in late March, just 2 months before its electoral mandate was about to expire. In Israel, Rabin resigned due to United States deposits of himself and his wife. The prime minister, freely elected of a great country, and a man probable to be reelected again, and he resigns. And the English and the Israeli government is in a different situation in terms of stability. In Germany, the ruling Social Democratic Party of Schmidt was trounced 6 weeks ago in its traditional Hesse stronghold. It lost every major city in Hesse, including Frankfurt. And so the Social Democratic and Free Democratic Coalition in the Federal Republic of Germany is under pressure. In India, the government of Madam Gandhi was stunningly upset in an election that she called figuring that she had it ice cold. In Sweden, 8 months ago, the incumbent government was reversed after 30 years. In Canada, in the province of Quebec, an election was held, and the astonishing result was that the incumbent government was ousted by separatists. In Italy, the Christian Democrats have been able to govern the last 6 months only because the opposition has abstained from voting on key issues. The Christian Democrats have agreed to greater collaboration with the communists and the socialists in order to maintain even tenuous power. Rome is paralyzed for a day when 1.5 million people walk off their jobs, and people are noting an alarming wave of violence in Italy. And while all this is occurring in the United States, there's an election and an incumbent president is ousted. Granted, he was different from preceding incumbent presidents, but that's rare. Now, if you step back from all of this, you can make two other observations. Look at our own country and what we've done to presidents since 1960. Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson had to quit under fire, in effect. Agnew was thrown out, the first vice president in history. Nixon was thrown out, the first president in history. And an incumbent president was defeated. And that's since 1960. Suppose we had met 5 years ago in this room, and we were talking about, well, who would be the most stable, powerful political leaders? What would we have theorized? We would have said, well, probably those who are the head of rich countries, because they have the material wherewithal to take ferment and adjust to it a little bit. Countries that have their leaders freely elected, and therefore the leaders are legitimate. Countries that are not under great military peril, in countries probably that have a free press and all of that, so that people are very used to the give and take of society and can take strain. So, of course, the most secure and stable of all political figures would be who? The Chancellor of West Germany in Western Europe, the Prime Minister of Japan in Asia, and the President of the United States in North America. We would have been talking about Tanaka, Brandt, and Nixon. Tanaka's in jail. Brandt had to resign because of a communist spy allegedly found in his government, or found in his government. And Nixon is out of jail because of a pardon. Now, maybe these prime ministers and presidents and chancellors are weaker than preceding prime ministers and chancellors and presidents, or men of less character or less able or that sort of thing. That's a clear possibility. But something very unusual is beginning to happen, or I should say is happening, that I think we only dimly perceive because we tend, all of us, to be parochial and look at our own situation and say, well, our situation's different than everybody else. We had Watergate, or we had that sort of thing, just as the people in Quebec would say their situation is different, or France, or Italy, or England, or Belgium, or Holland, or India. It's only when you step back and realize that something unusual is happening everywhere where there's a parliamentary democracy, or something loosely associated with parliamentary democracy, that one begins to conclude maybe something more extraordinary is happening. Time, on April 4th, had an article called "What's Going Wrong?" They said that European leaders are sullen and depressed by concern that something very fundamental may be going wrong in Western Europe. Ideology doesn't appear to be the issue, because it's the Social Democrats who are under pressure in England and in Germany and Holland. And it's more or less centrist governments that are under pressure in France and in Italy and Belgium. So it isn't that governments of the left or governments of the center are feeling more pressure. They all are. Leo Labetz, the brilliant writer of Survey, was quoted recently as saying that the weakening of the fabric of political structures throughout Western Europe, the diminution of authority that affects all the institutions, is occurring, the family and the church, as well as the state. Now, the question as to what it all means, and whether it has any real relationship to the communications revolution, are for us to ponder. The New York Times recently had an article asking, is there a global trend against incumbent regimes? And a number of people commented. Dr. William Schneider commented and was quoted in the Times. And he said the most important thing is that the trends don't indicate that voters are moving to the right or left. He said the voters simply want to change. It's simply the normal working of democratic politics, and there's nothing abnormal or a crisis about it. And Dr. Walter Dean Burnham of MIT was quoted as saying, well, the trend is against incumbents, but it's also probably unprecedented in the recent history of the West. And Dr. Seymour Martin Lipset of Stanford said the growth in state power makes incumbent governments more responsible when things go wrong. So as the state gets clearer in its authority, people know, if they can, who to throw out. And Dr. Verba of Harvard said that voter expectations are rising at the same time governments are handicapped by the energy crisis. Well, you have very distinguished professors from Harvard and Stanford and MIT and Hoover, and they differ on what's happening. But the very clear point to keep in mind is that something really fundamental seems to be happening. And I submit to you that its coincidence in time is related to the maturing of the communications revolution. Now, let me depart from that for a moment and go to this matter of nationalism. The old order, as we talked about, was broken by two wars, by World War I, when the land-based empires broke. Bangladesh is a basket case economically. But what it says is, I don't want to be ruled by any other nation. Or in the language of the kids, we are going to do our own thing, come hell, high water, parents, authority, or institutions. In Cyprus, island I happened to visit when I was at the USIA. What a paradise. Little island over in the eastern Mediterranean. 625,000 people, water, blue Mediterranean, sunny skies. The trouble is that there are 500,000 Greeks and 125,000 Turks on the island. They're rather similar. You really find it difficult to tell them apart if they're not talking. But they can tell each other apart, and they hate each other. And the island is torn to pieces by a violent struggle. Does it make any economic sense? Does it make any sense at all? No. Nationalism. The Persian Gulf. All the little sheikdoms of the Persian Gulf now want to be independent states. They want to do their own thing, and they go into the United Nations. In Africa in the 1960s, you run in Africa from 4 or 5 independent states in 1960 to some 43 by 1970 are independent states if you describe or define an independent state by one that's a member of the United Nations on its own. Run up to today in Spain. Fraga talked, this wonderful gentleman that Bob Moss talked about, and who was at one point the Minister of Communications like USIA, and when I came to know him. And so when he went to Washington recently, I spent some time with him. And he was talking about the problems of Spain. He said one of the real subterranean problems of Spain is the problem of the Basques and the Catalans. They want to rip up the pea patch. It's very dangerous for Spain. It can be maneuvered by outside people. It's economically very unwise. Do you think that makes the slightest bit of difference to the Basques and the Catalans? In Yugoslavia, everyone in this room has a visceral fear of what will happen politically, socially, militarily in Yugoslavia when Tito dies. Will the Croats and the Serbs go after each other? In East Europe, you have a cauldron of nationalism. The Sonnenfeld doctrine, a very bad doctrine in my personal judgment. But what was it rooted in? It was rooted in fear that the present unnatural relationship, as Sonnenfeld unfortunately called it, between Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union would explode by unnatural. He meant that they weren't accommodating to Soviet power. And why weren't they? Because of nationalism. East European national pressures broke two empires in this century, Turkey and Austria-Hungary. The clash between Soviet dominance and Eastern European nationalism has led to substantial use of military force 3 times since World War I. In Berlin in 53, in Budapest in 56, and in Prague in 68. Now, only then in the most cursory way, it is clear that there has been a revolution of nationalism that has occurred in coincident time with the communications revolution. That is to say, it all started about the time of World War I, and it is now escalating. You look this very day, Ethiopia, Eritrea. Is that the way you pronounce that, Bill? Eritrea wants to break off from Ethiopia. In Zaire, its southernmost province, Katanga, which has little ethnic relationship to the Congo at large, and desired independence at the time that Zaire became independent, it didn't get it because the UN and the US thought that it was very important to keep the minerals in the larger state of the Congo so it would be economically viable. But they don't want to be ruled by the other people in Zaire, and they're trying to get independent. In South Africa, as Bob Moss referred, there are not 25 million South Africans. What there are different groups in South Africa of whites and blacks and coloreds and Asians. I was startled when I went to South Africa. I know many of you are much more sophisticated in these matters than I am. I didn't know that of the 18 million blacks there, there aren't 18 million blacks. There's nations. There's the Zulus with 4.3 million, and there's the Xhosas with 2.5 million, and they can't talk to each other. They have no more ability to communicate than you and I do to a Pole or to a Frenchman unless we speak the language. So what you really have is not a state at all. You have a collection of tribes, of nations. Now, I'll cut short this part on nationalism only to say that it would be very wrong of us to consider that this is confined to the third world or to people who are less civilized than we are. In Belgium, all the political parties have agreed that the unitary state of Belgium is for all practical purposes finished. In the last 15 years, the country has been reorganized on a cultural basis into two separate communities. There is not yet any agreement on federalization, but there's a common feeling that between Flanders and Wallonia, they will separate. In the United Kingdom, Scotland wants to be separate and Wales wants to be separate, and it was considered a joke 5 years ago, and now it's a matter of parliamentary crisis. In Canada, the Quebec separatists vote to leave. That's extraordinary in itself, little item. They've encouraged the West Canada separatist groups. And Mr. Fleming, who's president of something called the West Canada Party in British Columbia, said last week, "Do not underestimate us. Our next election will be fought on separatism." And even in the United States, the Indians want Maine. What does it mean? We in the United States are least able to perceive what the force of nationalism is due to our history, because we all came from people who left a national group for the purpose of founding a new state in an empty land, or a land that we made empty by shooting the Indians. And that will never happen again. And we did amalgamate. But our experience has been atypical in all of history. And so we as Americans really have no visceral stomach feeling about the force of nationalism. That's very dangerous if we're the most powerful nation in the world and have to conduct foreign policy. It's also true that both Marxism-Leninism in its theories and the Enlightenment in its theories in the 19th century had precepts that presumed the withering of nationalism. But it didn't happen. Professor Harold Isaacs of MIT, a specialist in national minorities, said in the Times a week ago, "This process is taking place," he's talking of nationalism, "on a universal scale. Wherever you look at the world scene today, it is the same boiling cauldron. This is not a case of history repeating itself. It has never happened before." Now I want to move to the last matter that I was going to talk about. Why have I talked about the communications revolution and nationalism? Because although it's an interesting phenomenon in the West, we probably will be able to work our way through it if we stay strong enough and if we're not threatened by an outside force. It seems to me, and I've thought this through in general terms but not specifically, that we have here the makings of something very fundamental in terms of what will probably happen in the Soviet Union in the years ahead. Up till now, the communist societies have been able to interdict the communications revolution, so they have not had the instability and the effects of the communications revolution by and large within their society. I submit to you that that's a very important point. And the totality of the interdiction is really awesome. I shall never forget in China when Bill Rogers was waiting to see Chu Enlai, which was his compensation prize while Nixon and Kissinger were seeing Mao. And he was waiting in the anteroom, and there was a young lady sitting there, and she had what looked like a big advertising thing under her arm. And Rogers, through the interpreter, said to her, "What is that?" And she said back very openly through the interpreter, "Oh, that's the front page of tomorrow morning's, the layout of the front page of tomorrow morning's newspaper for the premier's approval." The totality of the communist interdiction of the communications revolution is something we only dimly perceive. The reason they don't let people in and out of those societies is basically because people will have face-to-face communication. They interdict the airplane and they interdict the automobile. They control all their television. They control all their print. And so all of the things that you and I are talking about what is happening in our time as a result of communications and nationalism has been interdicted at the borders of the communist societies, but now it's starting to leak. And that's what's really happening. That's the real reason that we underestimated and they underestimated the force of Helsinki. And it's the real reason, I think, for the increasing ferment within the Soviet Union. It has to do with the fact that the leakage has begun. in the last great imperialism that exists on the face of the earth, that because the Soviet Union, of course, as you would all know, is not by any means a national state. It is a collection of nations, a carryover from the Tsars. The Russians are in a minority. There's tension between Mother Russia and all of the nations that the Tsars conquered that are what? In their ancestral territory, speaking their ancestral language, with their ancestral culture that was there for centuries, and they've been seized. The ethnic Russian population is declining. Almost every minority is outbreeding them, in some cases by 4-1 in the case of the Muslim Central Asians. Radio Liberty broadcasts into the Soviet Union in 20 languages. Can you imagine what that means? People who speak 20 different languages and can't talk to each other in their native tongue. Even VOA broadcasts in 9 languages. In the United States, people do not consider themselves nationals. In the Soviet Union, one is Russian, one is Ukrainian, one is Armenian, one is Azerbaijani, one is Latvian, one is Estonian, one is Lithuanian. And you don't ever call anybody in the Soviet Union, you know this also much better than I do, a Russian, unless they're a Russian. It's the first briefing the State Department gives you when you go, or you insult them terribly. They have an enormous semantical problem. Imagine having a semantical problem about what do you call yourself? What do you call yourself if you live in the Soviet Union? If you're part of the communist apparatus and want to refer to all the people, you can't call them Russians. So what you call them is something called Soviet man. And in all of their propaganda, they refer to Soviet men. And we play along with it by calling them Soviets. The 40% of the Central Asian recruits that they have in the Russian army speak very limited Russian. Now, where does all this come out? As I said, I wanted to make with you here some general observations that I feel are important, mostly as a thought pattern for you. It has been known for a very long time in the way we conduct our foreign policy that we play a little bit on the nationalities question. But we've never really done much with it. Some of the best people in the CIA no longer believe in it. They think that the central authoritarian power in the Soviet Union is now so great that it won't really work in terms of discontent within that body politic. Lenin put great emphasis on solving the nationality question. His precept was that it would wither. The Russian policy is Russification, or rather an enforced Russification gradually over a period of time of all of the nations. Their goal is one Soviet nation and one Soviet man. How would we conduct foreign policy to relate to that? You would immediately run into a legal problem, because do you really have the right to deal in something in which the only solution is a breakup of the state? You can deal with human rights, and you can handle that within the framework of a legal state. But if you start to deal with nationalism, it is not handleable within the legal structure of the state as it presently exists. When and if East Canada separates from Canada, there will be two states. When and if Scotland separates from England, there will be two states. What happened in the breakup of the empires was separate states. What is happening in the breakup of India is separate states. What will probably happen in the breakup of Yugoslavia is separate states. What happened in French Indochina is separate states. You can't deal with nationalism within the framework of a present state, because what the people want is not cultural autonomy. What they want is to do their own thing. And every single government, almost without exception, that has dealt with nationalism has misjudged that. We will give them cultural autonomy and they will be satisfied, and they aren't, and they break up the pea patch. Now, what does that mean then for the last empire that exists on the face of the earth? There's a military imbalance. There's the enormous power of the Soviet Union. And they're sitting on a keg of dynamite. Because sooner or later, the Georgians, the Latvians, the Estonians, the Lithuanians, the Ukrainians, the Armenians, the Uzbeks, the Azerbaijanis, the Turkic peoples of Central Asia, are going to realize that they're the last people on the face of the earth that can call themselves a nation by what mankind commonly describes as a nation. Common ancestral territory, common language, common cultural values, and a desire and a will to be a nation and hold their national identity. Those are the criteria by which we define nation, and they exist in all or almost all of the submerged minorities of the Soviet Union, and they're the last ones left on Earth. Now, should we play with this? Suppose that we were to take the broadcast of Mr. Livesque of Canada, and we were to put it on Radio Europe and Radio Liberty and VOA. And now we're quoting a third party. We're quoting René Livesque of Quebec, who said, "We believe we are a nation with all the essential requirements, clearly defined territory, our own history, common language and culture, and the collective will to live together and maintain national identity. Our objective is political sovereignty. The important question is not whether Quebec will become independent, nor indeed when it will happen, but how." You put that into the Soviet Union in 20 languages, and you're playing with political dynamite. The three Baltic nations, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, small minor point of policy, we've never recognized the fact that they're part of the Soviet Union. They still have their representatives in Washington. They're never invited anywhere, and no one ever goes to see them. But the formality is there. There's a trap in the UN. There are three states of the Soviet Union that are formal members of the United Nations: Russia, the Ukraine, and Belarus. Well, it's a joke to have three states in the UN that are Russian. The reason is Stalin wanted three votes, and we caved in and gave him the three votes. But now you have a situation where there's the formality of representation on states involving the Ukraine. And what could be done with that? The sensitive question of what our policy should be and how should we relate to it, of international broadcast, of relating to nationalist groups, is to me a fundamental of our foreign policy, which has enormous importance for the United States and the West, and one that we as a group of people who care about those things might consider. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shakespeare. Really fascinating speech. Addressed a very basic question of foreign policy. I found especially fascinating these comments on the fractionalization of both long-established and new nations in the world. It certainly presents us with a new range of problems. And I think your talk demonstrated very clearly that there is a new order of both personal and national experience in this era of electronic communications. Now we will hear from two very interesting commentators, two very able minds. First discussant is Dr. William Schneider, Jr., professional staff associate on the Subcommittee on Defense, Committee on Appropriations of the U.S. House of Representatives. Dr. Schneider is a consultant to the Hudson Institute and a contributor to many military journals and journals dealing with strategic studies. He has a Ph.D. degree in economics from New York University, and he is co-author of the following works: Why the ABM, Policy Issues and the Missile Defense, Food, Foreign Policy and Raw Materials, Arms, Men, and Military Budgets, Issues for the Fiscal Year 1977. Dr. Schneider.
Frank Shakespeare took the liberty of a former government official and decided not to prepare his remarks in advance. As a consequence, some of my discourse may not necessarily respond directly to points he made, but I'm going to try and respond to some of the implications of some points I think he brought up. To begin with, I want to start out with a proposition that I believe that Frank has attributed far too much significance to the power of communications. This assertion may respond to the fact that people tend to like to flex well-developed analytic muscles, and if you are in the communications business, you tend to attribute a lot of influence to communications, whereas if you are selling copper pots, that might seem to be somewhat more important than communications. Nevertheless, let me just make a couple of comments about communications first before getting into some other points. To begin with, I think communications does have an important mischief value. That is, regardless of what the reality is, communications can create a certain amount of confusion. I can just cite two that have emerged within the past hour or so. There is a scurrilous fellow associated with Harvard named who shares both my Christian name and surname, and has been widely quoted, and I've had an enormously difficult time trying to persuade people that I am not, in fact, responsible for those statements made. Yet, even in these remarks, I find this scurrilous character quoted. One example of the mischief power of communication. Another example, and I think one of the let's say data points that suggest that we may have some problems is in the collection of books that we have out in the tables in the anteroom adjacent to this room. There is a particularly vile piece of American anti-American propaganda by a fellow who is not a pacifist, who recommends a essentially the disestablishment of the U.S. defense policy, and yet this kind of thing parades as I think some sort of libertarian tract, but as a practical matter, it suggests that we have real communications problems just among ourselves. And this reflects not so much the power of the electronic media or the print media or anything else, but merely an inability to make each other understood. I think we should attribute some important values to communication, and I certainly wouldn't dismiss them. We had a very moving statement last night about the importance of culture and the real need to try and find better ways to communicate the essential values of our culture. And I think in the long run, communications is extremely important to that because our culture is, does in fact exist. It has a very long history and has very many important elements that can only be transmitted through some kind of communications media. And I certainly would support some kind of Kulturkampf, which certainly seems to be necessary if any of the evidence that we've seen in the past few years means anything. But saying all that, I still think it Frank's statements tend to overstate the significance of communication. What we, I think, have to focus on is what, for want of a better word, we call real things, not things that are have reality only because they get communicated or get distorted in the communications process. And again, at the risk of flexing well-developed muscles, let me work on my particular hobby horse, which happens to be military power. It happens not to be entirely unrelated to Frank's statement, because he was speaking a good deal about the international dimension of our public policy concerns. And Frank went to some lengths to discuss the situation in Europe and attributed a good deal of the malaise or worse that we see in Europe to the problems of communication. Well, I'd like to suggest that the real problems in Europe are fundamental and are not associated with communication, and are not necessarily made either better or worse by the existence of more efficient means of communication. I'd like to cite as a principal example the issue of military power in Europe, particularly the imbalance in the same. The real reason why West European powers are appear to be extraordinarily weak is because they have a perception that, as compared to Soviet power and the potential, if that power were exercised, would leave them with absolutely no ability to run their own affairs. This a sort of an axiom that I've repeated in a number of forums, but I'll use it here because I think it's pertinent, is that international relations is the only field of human endeavor where agreements made under duress are considered valid and binding. And it's in some ways a sort of trivial observation, but nevertheless it seems to be one of the more transcendent points made this afternoon. I'd just like to acquaint some of you. Many of you are already acquainted with some of the details, but I always find the statistics important reading because they tend to make it more easy to understand why Europe is so weak, why West Europeans appear to be so incapable of responding effectively, and you have all of this centrifugal forces that Frank mentioned, especially in Western Europe. The Soviet Union now deploys about 36,000 tanks west of the Ural Mountains. Taken with armored personnel carriers and artillery, these are the three principal means of conducting offensive warfare. The United States has about 8,000 tanks in its inventory, including those at the Aberdeen Museum. The Soviet Union deploys 55,000 armored personnel carriers. The United States has 21,000, about half of which have gasoline propulsion, which General Patton denounced in 1942. We still have them. The Soviet Union has about 21,000 artillery pieces in its inventory. The United States has about 2,000. Just to give you a piece of data that suggests the significance of this disparity. In examining the way the Soviets would conduct a war in Europe, it's a sort of an updated version of the World War II Blitzkrieg that the Germans made famous. And this would involve thrusts in about six areas in, across the West German border. The Soviet tactic is to blast a hole through Western defenses about 4 kilometers wide by, 8 kilometers wide by 4 kilometers deep. The salvo weight, as it's called, the amount of tons of explosives that the Soviets can put on a target is about 18,000 tons in this 4 by 8 kilometer area. That's about 65 rounds per acre. And I assure you that would make it a very undesirable place to live in a very short period of time. These kind of statistics, I submit, are not lost on people, and the whether or not the United States is effective in communicating its good intentions to East European dissidents, whether or not the United States is effective in communicating the need for Western resolve and Western solidarity, these are all undermined by the fundamentals or real things that I think transcend whether or not information can be effectively communicated. The real disparities in capabilities are the things that I think are more fundamental to especially international relations than mere perceptions that, however they may be communicated with or without distortion. I think is something that is inadequately communicated. And let me mention just another example. If you look at the consequences of post-Vietnam politics, or when at least when it became clear in the Pacific Basin that the United States was going to withdraw from the Pacific, you had a reversal in where the governments in Australia, New Zealand, Japan, all went left. That is, the existing relatively conservative regimes were replaced with somewhat more liberally or socialist-oriented regimes that initially sought an accommodation with the communist forces in East Asia. It's only in the past year or so that we've seen a reversal of this as the self-confidence of the say conservative states of the Pacific Basin, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and to some extent Korea, have decided that they are going to try and take care of their own defense rather than rely on the United States. This again, I argue, is something that is not predominated by what information is communicated, but by a genuine understanding of what the real balance of forces are. So. Another point relating to this is the overstatement of the importance of nationalism. Nationalism is no doubt a very powerful force, but it is not effective, as Mr. Sabolev noted last night, when you have a very well-organized totalitarian state that is efficient right down to the level of the family in suppressing dissent. And it is, again, these real things that predominate over what is communicated. I'll stop here and go on for questions.
In my opinion, means just the intensity of manipulation. It is pressing upon men patterns and authorities at once so glittering with modishness and so easy to follow that he cannot resist them. In such a process, reason and decency burn to ashes under the onslaught of fashionable conformities presented as liberation of mind. And this is exactly what the liberals want, although God knows why. Paradoxically enough, my message could occasionally be seen in the pages of liberal and fashionable journals. My natural allies, the American conservatives, turn down each one of my suggestions. Having some modest experience in what is here termed the struggle for the world, I offered my services to the United States Information Agency under the Nixon administration, another of my natural allies. The rest is silence. As for the struggle for the world, let us indulge in some juxtapositions. During the Korean War, pedestrians who passed by the American embassies in the East European capitals spontaneously took off their hats before the American flag hanging there. People were arrested by the dozens. It was the beginning of the 50s. When Bob Matthias won the decathlon for America in 1952 Olympics, people took to the streets in Warsaw in an eruptive pro-American demonstration that had to be dispersed by police. By the mid-60s, in my native Poland, America and Americans achieved a status of a woman once madly loved, but who can be only deeply scorned for what she did to one who gave her the most tender feelings. I'm sorry to report, ladies and gentlemen, that the United States Information Agency, an institution created to channel the communications explosion into the struggle for the world, has as much of a share in this ominous change of heart as has any dim-witted New York Times man for his off-target articles about communism and Eastern Europe. This agency managed both the interests and the image of America in such a way that soon a saying circulated at the Warsaw University: join the Communist Party and the Americans will lavish on you a State Department travel grant or a Ford Foundation fellowship. As the rumor went for years and still goes on in Warsaw, a Polish censor arrives each month in Vienna to discuss with the local USIA men the content of the upcoming issue of America, the Polish language Washington-based publication. I'm inclined to believe this rumor, and moreover, I am positive that had the Americans chosen to kick the censor in the pants, that is, if they had shown some ideological guts, their journal would nevertheless have appeared in Warsaw at the scheduled time. However, for years, they have meekly refrained from any political firmness of purpose and substituted it with cheap political casuistry of either liberal or Nixonian brand. And this is why they are now often detested in Budapest, Prague, and in Warsaw. This was the situation before President Carter entered the scene. Mr. Carter is not exactly the person I would like to invite for dinner, but I must unwillingly admit that he is the first president since Harry Truman who has put some sense into the struggle for the world by means of communications. I do not know what his ultimate motivation is or the inherent prime mover of his policy. Is he playing to the home audience? Is his idealism a matter of faith, conscience, or tactics? I know, however, that he is using the simplest, the most potent, and the most practical weapon that for some incomprehensible reasons has never been used before. Anyone engaged in the struggle for the world must first ask about the substance of his enemy's force, and then try to weaken it at any price. Human rights are for the communists eschatology. The refusal to grant them is the DNA of the communist statehood. Thus, anyone who addresses himself to the idea of dissent undermines the very foundation of the Soviet power. There is no more effective way to debilitate any imperialism than to lend a helping hand to those who oppose it from inside. The Russians know it. They didn't foment Pan-Slavism 100 years ago because of their love for Czechs or Serbs, but to decompose and destroy the Turks and the Habsburgs. This is exactly what Solzhenitsyn, Amalric, Bukowski, and a legion of refugees before them tried to communicate to the West. What they tried to explain is that the liberal hypocrisy, as well as Kissinger's makeshift Talleyrandism, are not only morally contemptible, but also rationally pointless. That silent diplomacy does not pragmatically assist the cause of freedom. And human rights. But that, naive as it sounds, the strong voice of truth does. To anyone who lived there, this is obvious. Only the shrillest scream for justice and liberty has a factual and practical value in this struggle. For the people who wage their fight there, only the bluntest visibility of their oppression and their dangers are operational for them. They are not afraid of martyrdom, only of stillness and hush. Was it ever necessary for America to have a propaganda bureaucracy in her struggle for the world? My answer is no. Never in history could we observe a phenomenon of folklore turning into world fashion. Fashion was always a universal and cosmopolitan notion. It reduced the regional paraphernalia to carnivals and masquerades. Then the blue jeans, American folkloring piece of garment, became the world fashion with an image-forming and penchant-shaping power that matched the impact of Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. Once upon a time, I wrote in the New Yorker, quote, "Irving Berlin's cheek to cheek or Jerome Kern's smog gets in your eyes means something different here than in Europe, where they symbolize the charm of worldly life, the essence of fashionable dreams about chic hotels, the cinematic hedonism of the century. Here in California, they are folklore, which miraculously transmutes into the new American universalism, that of moods. Today, the universe of sensations and emotions is constructed upon the law of communicating media which are American, even in the eyes and ears of those who are trained to hate America," end quote. If this is not a decisive advantage in the struggle for the world, I don't know what is. Theodor Adorno, a German emigre sociologist, corroborated my views when he wrote before the last war, quote, "There is no exaggeration in claiming that a modern mind constantly assimilates something American, even in the process of resisting Americanism. If it does not, it is tainted with something reactionary," end quote. So much for one Weimar liberal. So what about our communications explosion and our struggle for the world? Sol Bellow so describes Mr. von Humboldt Fleischer, the hero of his latest book, a decrepit poet. Quote, "Humboldt wanted to drape the world in radiance, but he didn't have enough material. The radiance he dealt in was the old radiance, and it was in short supply. What we needed was a new radiance altogether," end quote. This, I suppose, is where the American conservative thought gets its chance. I always believed that one becomes a conservative at the second glimpse at what is around one. Let us have another look at everything around us. Thank you.